Where's
Social Securities?
Oh, there she is.
Ready? Welcome, everyone, to the May 17, 2011 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We're going to start out on House Bill 2158. Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me. Before we do that, we'll start out on House Bill 3225. We'll open a public hearing on that. Representative.
Thank you.
I apologize for not seeing you right away.
Well, I just kind of blend in. don't try to stand out in the crowd. Well, thank you for having me today. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, serving Westland Tualatin. Well, I appreciate you having hearing this bill today. I just want to get into what House Bill 3225A is. You know, so as a mom and a consumer, I believe our community should be ones where we can live, work, shop, and play within proximity to our homes. And so in Westland, Wilsonville, Tualatin communities, our residents have a very strong connection to our local businesses. They have a desire to be engaged in the communities. And but, you know, right now, however, we've got a major roadblock to livable communities, and that's traffic. It's a terrible type of thing. If you go out, ever been out to Tualatin Sherwood Highway, it's kind of a mess, Tualatin Sherwood Road, especially during the daytime. So I was approached by the representatives of the South Metro Business Alliance and asked to consider sponsoring this legislation, and I was thrilled to do it. The result is a very creative solution to a long-term problem that has existed in my district for years. I was not surprised to learn that moving freight and people through Newburgh, Tigard, south of Highway 99, through Tualatin, onto I-5 has been a topic of discussion for decades. And while we've known this to be a problem for years and we've spent literally millions of dollars discussing and analyzing the conditions for more than two decades, the communities have grown, the traffic problems become worse, and we've yet to address solving the problem in a meaningful way. So time, money, environmental impact, has mired traffic has grown worse from year to year. During the process of drafting the legislation and moving it through the House, the bill has begun to take a kind of a life of its own. It's gained mayoral support from seven cities in Washington County, has been endorsed by the Tualatin City Council, been supported by three chambers of commerce, the South Metro Business Alliance, the Portland Metro Home Builders Association, and the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades have all got on board. It's evolved into be a very interesting piece of jobs legislation that's moving through the building this session, and truly, you know, jobs are what we all came here to go do and put Oregon back to work. So primary purpose of the legislation has been about opening up the Basalt Creek and Tonkin employment areas of Portland South Metro Business Region. This has been previously identified for industrial development. There's a few folks who've said, you know, this bill doesn't really create any jobs, but the reality is that, you know, we need family wage jobs in the area, and it's been stifled because of lack of transportation infrastructure. So it's also being kind of exacerbated by a state agency that doesn't have a real strong interest in getting to yes on facilitating job creation. So 3225A establishes a set of criteria that gets us to yes on moving forward with jobs for Oregonians in and around the South Metro region. It'll also open up land that's already been designated as industrial by both Governor Kulongowski and Governor Kitzhaber, as well as Metro and Washington County. It does not allow rampant paving of roads through farms and environmentally sensitive areas. So when passed, 3225A will finally allow the communities of Tualatin, Westland, Sherwood, and Wilsonville to close a loop on long-standing issues that have challenged their communities for years. It will also provide needed transportation infrastructure and actually create hundreds of new jobs, as many of us, again, like I said, promised we'd do during campaigns and talking to our constituents. Since the legislation passed the House, there were some additional concerns brought forward by the city of Hillsborough. It's my understanding that the cities of Wilsonville, Hillsborough, and Tualatin all got together, convened a meeting to discuss those concerns. The legislative intent behind this has never been to create problems for other jurisdictions or exchange one set of problems for another. In my mind, the type of issue that Hillsborough brought forward was actually kind of discussed in the House. We thought we addressed those kinds of types of concerns with the Dash 3 amendments before it passed out of committee, but Hillsborough staff still has some concerns about a Brookwood interchange project on Highway 26. They drafted some additional amendments, a Dash 6. They want to make sure they don't inadvertently disrupt the Brookwood project. We don't want to do that either. Brookwood project was part of the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act passed in House Bill 2001 last session. So again, we are looking for a solution to a serious problem in the South Metro area around traffic and congestion and opening up jobs. We're striving to put Oregonians back to work. We don't believe that this bill jeopardizes other community and projects, nor is that our intent in doing so. At this point, I think we want jobs anywhere in Oregon. We'll take them anywhere. And I'm not certain that the Dash 6 amendments are necessary, but I'm not going to oppose them either at this point. So I'm urging your support of the bill, facilitate these projects and get them going and get people back to work. Do pass recommendation would be helpful. Thank you. Any questions?
I think I heard you say you were okay with the A6 Hillsborough amendments.
I'm not going to oppose those at all. Like I said, we thought, the bill, when it was going through the House side, first it was kind of like I said in the committee there, it's kind of like the Goldilocks bill. First it was too big, then it was too small, then we thought we got it just right. Apparently we weren't quite there, but we thought we got there by taking out some language in the Dash 3 amendments would have made it comfortable for everyone. Hillsborough brought forward some concerns. We're happy to work with them on those. So the Dash 6 don't make or break the deal.
Thank you. Any questions for the representative? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the consideration.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I was asked if I wanted to have any testimony prepared on this bill, and I said no. And the reason I said no was because I thought it would be good to actually come and just talk to you about a little bit of history here, and a little bit of history of what process means and what outcomes mean. I go back a long way. My gray hair probably indicates that. Senator Starr knows how long I go back in transportation issues. In 1985, when I was on the Tualatin City Council, a few years later, we improved a little road called Tualatin-Sherwood Road, which actually was a Washington County project. It was part of one of the MSTIP proposals. It was actually Tualatin-Sherwood Road and Six Corners. There were Six Corners at that time. The project was a fairly big project at that time, I think roughly about $30 million, much of it being spent on the realignment of what was then Six Corners. It was supposed to be a stopgap proposal. It was supposed to take what in effect was basically just a farm-to-market road, make it into a modern facility, have multiple lanes closer into the city of Tualatin, and then go into three lanes into Sherwood. Ultimately, there was under discussion what was considered an I-599 connector. Actually, if I even went back a little bit farther, I would tell you that when 205 was built, if you go back in the archives, you will find a cloverleaf proposal that would have actually extended the freeway in the other direction. But this I-599 proposal, which was supposed to be the ultimate solution, at about that time, the estimated cost of it was about $58 million. Housing development in the southern portion of the city was not as extensive as it is now. Well, that I-599 proposal, because of the Federal Highway Administration, got all caught up in a study that was called the Western Bypass. Now, you can debate the Western Bypass any way you want to debate it. But the reality is for 10 years, I served on two different committees. One, I believe, called the Southwest Corridor Committee, and the other one, the Western Bypass Committee, and spent so many nights in meetings on this issue that I cannot recall them all. Ultimately, we decided that and made the recommendation that the portion between 99 and US 26 didn't actually fulfill the need, because, quite honestly, people were more interested in getting from Hillsborough to Beaverton than they were from Hillsborough to Wilsonville. But that the connector between I-5 and the 99 made a lot of sense. The problem was, by the time all that was completed, that connector would have cost more than $250 million. That was pursued for a while, and then communities were asked to look at various alternatives. They settled on one alternative. One alternative is one being the one being presented to you today, or actually the fruition of that alternative. That's the connection of 124th. It would connect relatively near, it's already there actually, in place, between about 99W through to Tewalt and Sherwood Road, and then ultimately on to basically the interchange there at the northern part of Wilsonville. Well, that is the preferred alternative. That is actually what's in all the transportation plans. The first portion of that has been constructed, the 124th from approximately 99W, doesn't connect exactly, but it connects on another road, all the way to Tewalt and Sherwood. The second portion of that would be from Tewalt and Sherwood to the northern Wilsonville exit. By the way, the I-599 connector now is, I believe, estimated, if you were to do it now, at well over $500 million. So part of this seems to be that when you are so engaged in process and transportation, you just hold projects out so long that they become prohibitively expensive. What I'm trying to point out here is process. Process is good, but process that doesn't lead to the right outcomes is not good. The reality here is people have been asked to work to look at an alternative. This particular alternative addresses part of the need. Those of you that are not familiar with my district and represent Parrish's district, Tualatin has quite a bit of industrial land away from the freeway. Wilsonville obviously has a lot of industrial land close to the freeway and actually away from the freeway also. This road would basically provide another avenue for truck traffic that is trying to go south on I-5 to get through the community rather than going on Tewalt and Sherwood Road, or if they're trying to go north onto 99W, not have to go all the way to Sherwood before they could go north. This will actually open up some new areas for industrial development, will lead to some of the things we all seem to talk about here but nobody seems to do much about, and that is create jobs. This connector, the thing that's holding this up is two things. One is money, and that's not being asked for here today. But the proponents of this need to get sort of a green light so that they can get a little bit farther down this process, so that they can get the money, probably largely local money, to make this connection. And secondarily, so that in a roadway that I think in total will be probably 4 or 5 miles, so they can make the last half-mile connection, potentially if they need to, between two suburban communities, both within the urban growth boundary, through an area that is actually going to be designated an urban reserve. You may be told that it'll probably be brought into the urban growth boundary relatively soon. But my communities have been told, wait for process for a very long time, 25 years. They followed the process. They are looking to get this last particular segment so that they can go out and solve part of their problems. And what they're being told and what you will hear is that LCDC still has a process that they need to complete for exceptions. But I will tell you quite honestly, I don't think that they're going to disallow connections between two urban areas where they've actually, and Metro has actually, brought those two areas together and has designated more land for development. What they're not going to tell you is that they can guarantee that the whole area will be brought inside the urban growth boundary. But the real reality here is you have two communities with more industrial land to develop, with more jobs to create, and what they would like is just the green light today so that they can proceed in developing the land that's been either already brought into the urban growth boundary or will be brought into the urban growth boundary shortly. Incidentally, my understanding is the area that is urban reserve that might have to be transacted is now a rock quarry, which might actually be abandoned by that time. So what you are potentially the issue here is whether they can run a road through a rock quarry. And I will leave it at that, Mr. Chairman. Sometimes process is important, but ultimately there has to be the right outcomes.
Senator, let me ask you, have you seen the, I think they're Hillsborough proposed amendments, the A6s?
Yes, I have.
And you okay with those?
I'm okay with those.
Okay. Questions in Senator Rock?
Yeah. This seems to be a specific cure for a specific situation. I would ask you that maybe we need to look at land use in general, because I think a lot of cities are having problems. I think a lot of landowners are having problems doing development, and maybe that we need to look at the land use system as a whole and make some changes instead of trying to fix little parts that aren't working. Yeah, that's my own.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Girard, I've been involved around these issues for about 30 years, and I will tell you, sometimes I think the system works, sometimes I think the system doesn't. What I'm basically saying here is the jurisdictions that I represent and the people that live in those jurisdictions have tried to play by the rules. They're actually trying to do what people have told them they should do. They're not that always that energetic about the fact that the urban growth boundary has been expanded. But the reality here is that we have land, and Wilsonville now has land, that can be developed for more industrial development. We just need a few more road connections to that land so that we can put some more jobs in place for the state.
Okay. Any other questions for the Senator? Thank you, Senator.
Thank
Devlin.
You.
We'll let you go back to work.
Okay.
Let's see. I'm going to temporarily recess the hearing on 3225, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3273. Representative Wynyard.
I'd like to bring someone with me. Kevin Campbell from the
Sure.
Police Chiefs Association. I think we'll keep this brief.
We mind.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Matt Wingard, State Representative from House District 26. House Bill 3273 is a bill designed to assist the families of our fallen public safety officers in the darkest period of this whole event for them. It attempts to address an issue around their personal privacy in the few years directly after the moment in which their spouse is killed in the line of duty. So under current law, law enforcement officers are able to use their place of work as a registration point for their DMV records, which allows them and their families some privacy. The glitch in the law is that that is tied to the public safety officer, and at the moment that that person is deceased, the family is not entitled to that privacy. So the bill just extends it for 4 years so that the media attention that surrounds those events, those tragic events, can pass before that family moves back into public registration, if you will. I passed out testimony from Vicki Jeffries-Bilton, who is the widow who originally approached me with the idea for this bill. Her husband, Thomas Jeffries, was a Portland police officer who was killed in the line of duty in 1997, and as you'll read from her testimony, a tremendous amount of media attention ensued in the months after that. She was pregnant at the time, and there was a great deal of media interest in following that, and she had to go to some pretty extraordinary lengths to maintain some level of privacy through that whole process. Kevin Campbell's here. I'll let him speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kevin Campbell with the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'll be very brief. We support this bill. I want to thank the members of this committee who voted today in favor of the Governor's Medal of Ultimate Sacrifice. Obviously, this is a time when the needs of survivors are apparent because of the tragedies we've experienced over the last months and couple of years. And we've worked with Vicki and have heard her story. It is a devastating story for a survivor to have to go through the kind of media scrutiny that just naturally occurs when some of these incidents happen. So I appreciate Representative Wingard and his sponsorship of this bill and your support as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see, is there anybody else who would like to testify on 3273? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 3273.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 3273.
Senator Atkins has moved House Bill 3273 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 3273 is passed to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Senator Atkinson, would you like to carry that?
You bet.
Okay, so we'll close the work session and public hearing on House Bill 3273, and we will reopen the hearing on 3225. I have a number of people that are signed up. Let me start out here with Larry Harvey.
Thank you, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm here today representing the South Metro Business Alliance. I don't know that I could really add too much to not only the history, but the explanation provided by Senator Devlin. He's been extremely supportive and helpful. I will simply reassure you and reiterate to you that this is a bill that is in dire need of some support from you, simply because your local government colleagues in the cities of Wilsonville, Tualatin, Sherwood, etc., they simply need to be able to proceed with what they've been charged to do. I was asked a question earlier today, so I also want to clarify, this is not a funding bill. We're not asking for money. We're asking for your support in getting a decision to be made that will provide the opportunity to simply do what we need to do. This provides access. It will provide the opportunity to create access to land where jobs can be created. That's all there is to it. It's like selling a house that you can't drive to. It's hard to sell such a piece of property if you can't get there, and that's what we need. And I know there are folks that may believe that we're trying to do something else, but I can assure you there is no ulterior motive. We simply want to put Oregonians back to work. The land is available. Everyone wants to do that, and we're just tired of waiting on the process for everyone to get their 2 cents worth in. We believe that this is a good way to get there. Simply grant us the exceptions needed so that we can do the road and move forward with creating the jobs and develop the land that's been designated for that. So I hope that that clears up any questions that you might have about Senator Devlin's explanation. Again, I think that he did an absolutely great job, but if you have other questions, I'd be happy to answer those for you now.
Support the A6 amendments?
Yes, I participated in the meeting that included the city of Hillsborough, Wilsonville, Tualatin. We understand the concerns. Again, it's not our intention to try to create problems for others, so we want this bill not to create problems for Hillsborough or anybody else, for that matter, any other road situation, particularly that in the Jobs and Transportation Act. We've worked with Senator Starr as well, and so we believe the A6 amendments will get there.
Any questions of Mr. Harvey? Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, we got some city folks here. Sherlyn Lomas. And how about also Jack Eiselman and Pat Rabella?
Good afternoon, Senator Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Sherlyn Lomas, and I'm the city manager for the city of Tualatin. And I am here to testify in support of House Bill 3225, including the A6 amendments. The Tualatin City Council unanimously adopted a resolution in support of this bill. While the bill was requested originally by the South Metro Business Alliance, we have been actively monitoring the progress and status of the legislation, and the city has a vested interest in its passage. If passed, it will have a positive impact on the city of Tualatin and the entire South Metro area, as it will erase uncertainty about our ability to design and construct an extension of 124th Avenue. The City of Tualatin, along with our partners in Wilsonville, Sherwood, and Washington County, have been working on the concept plan for this area for quite some time. The development of this area holds the key to several issues in this region, not the least of which is a reduction of traffic congestion and enhancement of freight mobility. It is critical to the future growth of our city and the region as a whole. To launch this area, we need to support it with a viable transportation infrastructure. When Metro adopted the most recent regional transportation plan amendments that included the extension of 124th Avenue, we were relieved to think that we were finally on our way towards substantial progress. However, because a portion of 124th could potentially be located outside of the current urban growth boundary, we are precluded from proceeding with the development of the transportation infrastructure that is not only imperative to this community's development, but completely supported by all the jurisdictions involved. Development of the 124th Avenue extension is supported by not only our own plans, but also the Washington County Transportation Plan and Metro's Regional Transportation Plan. House Bill 3225 will allow us to proceed with implementing the directives that have been placed before us as local officials, namely design and construction of this critical and supported piece of infrastructure. We have recently collaborated with our partners in Hillsborough to amend the important legislation. We appreciate their partnership on this. I respectfully request that you pass this bill out of committee and send it to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Sure. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman appearing before you today on behalf of the City of Hillsborough. In 2009, through the leadership of many of you on this committee and some of your spouses, the legislature passed House Bill 2001, which included an appropriation for $45 million to help improve the Brookwood Parkway interchange at U.S. Highway 26 in Hillsborough near our major employment area. I'm joined today by Pat Rebellia, our planning director. We have worked with the City of Tualatin to develop the A6 amendments to this bill that address the critical need we have in developing that interchange pursuant to your act in 2009 to work within urban reserves on some adjacent roadways. And Planning Director Rebellia is here to discuss that in greater detail.
Chair Byers and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to say a few remarks about the bill. I have handed out some testimony.
Can I ask you to put your name on the record, please?
For the record, my name is Pat Rebellia, Planning Director for the City of Hillsborough. I've handed out some testimony, and it, attached to it is a map. And what you see in the map are proposed roadways that are co-designed by ODOT, Washington County, and City of Hillsborough staff that would make the interchange improvements being funded by the JTA Act work properly and safely, and enable the build-out of lands that are already in the industrial area inside the UGB. So we agree with all the remarks, the testimony so far about the A6 amendment. We hope that that will be the committee can pass it out with a due pass recommendation. What we're trying to do here in terms of the A6 amendment is to protect the integrity of the Brookwood Interchange, to let it do what the legislature wants it to do when they funded the JTA Act, to provide hopefully another 20,000 jobs in the existing UGB for our economy. So with that, I will end my remarks and be glad to happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, let's see. Randy Tucker and Rob Halliburton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I guess I get the unenviable task of being the spokesman for the process today. but please hear me out. Metro has so far not gotten involved in the, has not taken a position on the bill until today. However, we expressed some concerns in the House. Councilor Carl Hostica came down at the invitation of the House committee to describe the situation on the ground and the posture of the Metro Council. And basically, he made two points. And some of them have been made in previous testimony, or they've been foreshadowed in previous testimony. One is that the legislation addressing the road in Tualatin is unnecessary because the land is likely to come into the urban growth boundary once the urban and rural reserve process is completed later this year. And of course, I should note, just as a point of clarification, the legislation speaks about land in urban reserve, and right now we don't have any urban reserves in the region. There is an agreement between the three counties and Metro, or there are separate agreements between the three counties and Metro to establish urban reserves, and they have to yet be acknowledged by LCDC, which is scheduled or anticipated later this year. And the other concern that Councilor Hostica raised at the time that I've raised privately with people is the concern about the precedent of the legislature basically specifying what will happen in a particular location with respect to a land use decision. We didn't oppose the bill officially in the House, just kind of frowned at it. But after the House passage, the City of Hillsborough received a legal opinion that they shared with us that expressed concern that led to them drafting their amendment, expressed concern that the language of the bill would prevent the development of other roads besides the one specified in the A engrossed bill. So they drafted their Dash A6 amendment to address that concern. The Hillsborough amendment, or the amendment that's before you today, the Dash A6, cures the problem for the project at the Brookwood Interchange, but potentially leaves the same problem in place for any other project that might occur, might be appropriate in urban reserves going forward. And so what we've done is propose an amendment that's still at LC that I've distributed in just out of my computer here, that would resolve the underlying problem, which is the LCDC rule preventing exceptions for transportation facilities in urban reserves. Now, it directs LCDC to return on a short timeline and reconsider the decision they made that has led to this legislation coming before you in the first place. To be fair, LCDC, when they adopted that rule, I think indicated its willingness to reconsider it in the future, but only after the reserves were finalized, which, as I noted, is going to occur later this year in August. So the amendment that we would propose would direct that revisiting of the rule to occur on a very short timeline. Basically, it would have to start up within a month or so of the finalization of the reserves through the LCDC process. That would also recognize the desire of Tualatin and Hillsborough to get quick resolution of this, and also recognize the fact that there's a legislative session coming in 2012 where it's only 8.5 months away, shockingly. Of course, if there's no resolution by then, there's an opportunity then. So we present this to you. As I say, it's being drafted, but we'll see if it becomes moot by any action you might take today. But we present it to you as an opportunity to address the underlying concern that led to this legislation coming before you, and believe it's a better approach.
So, Randy, I'm led to believe that these are two of a number of small projects that are included in the transportation plan, sort of the west side of the metro. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the Brookwood Interchange is not a small project, but it's a project.
Small
project. Yes. I should thank you for the opportunity to actually clarify something that I didn't say. In proposing this language, we are not suggesting that we don't support the projects in question that you're discussing today. Both of them, as I as has already been testified, are part of the regional plan. Metro has supported both of those projects in the past. The Tualatin project has been discussed around the table at the Metro Policy Advisory Committee to general approval. As Senator Devlin testified, it is part of the replacement for the I-599W connector that was discussed for many years. My understanding, which is limited about that project, is that there are about seven projects that are on the table now to sort of replace the big bypass that was originally pursued, and that this is one of those projects. So it's not a question of support or opposition for these projects.
So it's just a process issue. Projects have been included in the plans and approved by the local governments?
Well, it's also there's an underlying problem that could affect other projects in the future, as well as the language of the legislation. The reason that Hillsborough came forward was concerned that the language of the AN Growth Bill would prevent their project from occurring, and with their amendment, it's our opinion that problem has not gone away for any other project that may be.
Hadn't gotten any worse, though, has it?
No, Mr. Chair, it has not.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Rob. Chair Byer, members of the committee, my name is Rob Halliburton. I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I don't think this is the first time I've been before you this session to talk about one of LCDC's rules, different one this time, the urban and rural reserve rules. It's been implied, I don't think anybody has said it outright, that the LCDC rule in this case does prohibit certain uses out within urban reserves in the metropolitan area, Portland metropolitan area, and one of those is to take an exception for transportation facilities. I would point out that rule was developed based on the recommendation of an advisory committee that was comprised of stakeholders from a variety of interests and across the region in the metro area. And our commission did take the recommendation from that advisory committee at that time, and who you're hearing from today were folks who didn't like that recommendation, but I wanted to point out that the rule does reflect at least, if not consensus, at least some agreement amongst the folks in the region. That said, I would also point out that, as Mr. Tucker stated, at the end of that rulemaking exercise, our commission did understand that there was further consideration of the rule needed and expressed willingness to do so, but I didn't say when. I will admit that. DLCD did provide testimony in the House on 3225. We did not opposed the bill. We had some concerns with the language in the introduced version of the bill. Those concerns were addressed. The language was fixed. We did not oppose the bill moving forward. We testified then, and I would renew, that we don't believe the bill is necessary for the road, for the connector between Tualatin and Wilsonville, that due to the facts on the ground and the process as it's moving forward, we believe that the road will be permitted long before they're ready to construct it. But we do not oppose the A version of the bill. Regarding the A6 amendments, we don't believe that it is worded well. We found four interchanges that it applies to, and we're concerned with the unintended consequences. It doesn't just apply to the one interchange. And as Mr. Tucker pointed out, we haven't even received final approval of the urban reserves yet. And final resolution of that through the courts could be some time off in the future. And we think the bill is the -6 amendments are unnecessary and ill-advised.
How do you square that, Rob, with the fact that, urban reserves aside, you've got a huge transportation problem on the west side, and it sounds, if I'm hearing this right, you've got the Metro Transportation Planning organizations and communities that have already sort of outlined these, and it's not lost on me what Senator Devlin had talked about of 30 years of planning with missed opportunities and increasing costs.
With regards to the Tualatin and Wilsonville connector, we haven't in any way objected or stated that we don't think that road is needed. There is, in fact, already an alignment in the regional transportation plan for that connector that stays within the UGB, and this bill would be unneeded for that alignment. This the local advocates desire a shorter alignment, and we're not disagreeing that the shorter, straighter alignment would be better, but it is already in the regional transportation plan under existing rules. With regards to the...
So let me see if I understand correctly. You're saying that this route is already included in the plan, but we shouldn't do it now because we should wait for the process to move forward?
Chair Barr, that's not what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
What we're saying is that the alignment that is in the plan now could move forward now without any need for a bill or any exceptions to any statewide rules. It could move forward because it's already inside the UGB. There's a proposed alignment where a segment of the road goes outside the UGB and it's in a proposed urban reserve, and because of LCDC's rules preventing an exception for a transportation facility in the urban reserve, that alignment is precluded. Am I making any more sense?
So is this alignment been considered by the transportation planning, whatever, I don't know what the group is called up there?
JPAC?
I mean, is this alignment consistent with that?
I don't know. I know that there's one in the regional transportation plan that stays inside the UGB, and that was adopted by Metro. Okay,
maybe I'll ask the city manager at Tualatin that.
And with regards to the interchange in Hillsborough, I'm sorry.
As we're going through the design of 124th, there are a number of alternatives, alternative alignments that have not been decided on. The preferred alternative is in the UGB, is outside the UGB in this urban reserve area. There are other alternative alignments, but none of them are as straight. Does that answer your question?
So this has been considered by the Transportation Planning Organization? Is it JPAC?
The corridor has been considered by JPAC, but the actual specific alignment of the road itself, there are probably six alternatives for how it could make the connection. And
locally, this is considered to be the best one?
Yes. The straight one that goes outside of the urban growth boundary,
okay.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You. Rob, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Chair Byer, you also asked how we squared what I just said with the needs for the local area, and it is a tougher nut, I believe, to crack in the Hillsborough example, but I would also state that I believe that LCDC is the appropriate venue to address that issue through their rulemaking.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Senator Rod.
This is more of a statement. I got to tell you, right now, this is bureaucracy at its worst. Yeah, this is a broken land use system, and what you have right at the dais right here is a perfect example of why land use doesn't work. What really strikes me as being really kind of humorous, this is where all the radical land use comes from, is the metropolitan Portland area. And so now you want a statute to fix the fact that you guys can't agree, and LCDC puts in a rule you don't like by administrative rule. So we have a broken land use system. LCDC shouldn't stand for local control doesn't count. And I just really think that it has gone amok. So, if you don't take back from this session that you are totally out of bounds, I don't know what the heck's going on. But this really, we have to do something about land use because it is costing thousands and thousands of jobs. We can't get an infrastructure we need. And by God, it comes right back on your agency.
Other questions? I'm not sure that was a question, but...
It wasn't a question, no.
Thank you very much. That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3225? Richard, do you have something for the record?
Yeah, I received a letter from Mary Kyle McCurdy of Thousand Friends of Oregon in opposition, and it was handed out during DLCD's testimony, but it was from Thousand Friends of Oregon. There's also no revenue impact and minimal fiscal on both the main bill and on the dash 6.
Okay. So we will close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 3225.
Mr. Chair, move the dash 6 minutes.
Senator Atkinson has moved the -6 amendments to House Bill 3225. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. I just wanted to recognize the work that and the good faith effort for the folks in the city of Tualatin working with folks in Hillsborough to come to compromise, and I appreciate that work. Appreciate that it comes to conclusion in the -6 amendments, which I hope are adopted. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any opposition to the motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll support the -6 amendment, but I will probably oppose the underlying bill, the overlying bill, or underlying bill.
The -6 amendments to House Bill 3225 are adopted. Senator Starr?
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3225 as amended by the -6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
Mr.
Senator Girard.
I'm going to vote yes on the bill, but I will discuss things on the floor that this is a representation of a broken land use system.
Other discussion?
Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I was persuaded by the desire to deal with the issue more comprehensively, and that's my reason. There's probably a lot of merit to what this bill is trying to do, but I'd rather see it done in a more comprehensive way.
And I would note that Senator Devlin made, I think, a fairly eloquent historic perspective on this and the fact that dragging these things out too much has cost the citizens of that region of the state hundreds of millions of dollars, and maybe it's time to get on and solve some problems. So I will be supporting the motion. Further discussion? Okay. Is there any opposition, Senator Burdick?
Yes.
Senator Burdick is opposed. Anybody else? House Bill 3225, as amended by the -6, is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Now
Senator Burdick is opposed. Senator Starr, would you like to jointly carry this with Senator Devlin?
Yes, that's fine. Or he can do it by himself. I mean, it's his bill.
We'll work that out.
I'd be happy to assist.
All right, so we'll close on House Bill 3225, and we'll move back up the top of the agenda, and we will open a, open a work session on House Bill 2157. Richard?
Senate Bill 2157 requires an applicant for a landscaping contract business license that is registered as a non-exempt independent contractor to provide workers' compensation insurance coverage. We heard this bill on May 2nd, and there's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
I'm unclear of the committee's position on this one. Is there any discussion on this?
Mr. Chair, I'd just make a comment. I have a lot of folks, constituents that are landscape contractors. I've got family members that are landscape contractors. I have friends that are landscape contractors. And the one common theme I hear from all of them is there's enough regulation already in the landscape contracting world, and we don't need more regulation. Please don't pass any more laws regulating landscape contractors. I see this as more regulation coming from the state on landscape contractors, and I'm not super excited about passing more regulations on landscape contractors.
I'll take that as a likely no. Does anybody else want to express a position? Is there anybody who would like to move the bill? Well, I see an overwhelming...
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
I'll move House Bill 2157A to the floor.
Okay.
Recommendation.
Senator Edwards has moved House Bill 2157 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Let's call the roll.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Edwards?
Aye.
Senator Broad?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
No.
Chair Byer?
Aye. House Bill 2157 appears to have gained a majority to go to the Senate floor. With a due pass recommendation, we'll close on that. And Senator Edwards.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know that I have the same.
Huh?
I don't know that I have the same feelings about.
I think he does.
Carrying the bill. I was on to the next one.
Okay. You're carrying this
one. Okay. I'll carry this one. That's fine.
We'll open work session on House Bill 2158. Discussion on this one.
Mr.
Chair, I'll move House Bill 2158
okay.
to the floor with
Senator
a due pass.
Senator Durant has moved House Bill 2158 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair, I'm still not... I've talked a little bit with landscapers in my district, and frankly, they're not really clear on whether or not this is a good thing.
I think we've got our bills mixed up here.
No, I don't have my bills mixed up. And because I double checked on that, Senator Gerard. And so, you know, I'm not persuaded yet that this is a good step. So,
I appreciate that, Senator. I, on the other hand, think that this one is actually more permissive and allows more flexibility for the industry and the people
that's,
in it.
That's what
probably that, well, why take decreases regulation rather than increasing it. But that's one opinion.
And Mr.
Anybody
Chair,
else?
Can I respond really quickly?
You sure can.
I, in my opposition between now and the floor, if I can get to a better understanding of exactly what this bill, how it will affect some very significant landscape contractors in my district, then, you know, I may support it on the floor. But as of now, they're not clear that this will do that for them.
They're
so.
Confused. Okay.
Yeah.
Other comments? Let's call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Edwards?
No.
Senator Gerard?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Mr. Ackerson?
No.
Aye. I think that would take us to a tie, and apparently that motion has failed. So we will close the work session on House Bill 2158. We will open on House Bill 3490.
Richard. House Bill 3490 specifies which county providers workers' compensation coverage to qualified search and rescue volunteers. It clarifies that qualified search and rescue volunteers can be acknowledged at the scene by a sheriff's designee. Declares an emergency effective on passage. If you recall, we heard this measure on May 9th, and at the time, Senator Gerard asked an amendment to be made. That amendment is the -A3 amendment that clarifies that the county sheriff or sheriff's designee is the point person to send volunteers to another county. There's no fiscal and no revenue on the bill or the amendment.
Okay. In work session, the chair would move the -3 amendments to House Bill 3490. Discussion on the motion? Is there opposition to the motion?
Did you move the amendment?
I did.
I did move the amendment. Did I say that right, Carolyn?
Mm-hmm.
I did. Okay. That's what I thought I did. I moved the A3. To be clear, we are... The motion is to adopt the A3 amendments to House Bill 3490. Is there any opposition? There is none. The A3s are adopted. Chair moves House Bill 3490 as amended by the A3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there opposition to the motion? Seeing none. House Bill 3490 as amended by the -3s is passed to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation, and we'll close work session on House Bill 3490.
I'll carry it.
Senator Gerard will carry. All right, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2139. Richard.
House Bill 2139 modifies existing requirements that applicant provide proof of social security number for driver's license, driver's permit, or identification card. It allows the Department of Transportation to extend the term of application for temporary driver permits for persons who require additional time to produce required documentation. There is no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
Amy.
Minimal revenue, and generally speaking, impact.
Lots of confusion on this one. What does this do?
Well, I hope not. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation.
Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division. House Bill 2139 is a customer service bill. It does two things. It extends the amount of time in temporary permits that the DMV can grant to folks while they try to gather the documentation necessary to prove legal presence and identity for the sake of obtaining and renewing a driver license or identification card. And the second thing it does is it removes the requirement that folks show up with their Social Security card or other official document showing their Social Security number, because when a person shows up and provides that Social Security number at the desk at DMV, the clerk turns and types that number into a computer database, a national computer database, which instantly from the federal government verifies that that Social Security number belongs to that person. And so what has happened in a number of situations is that folks show up with all of their documents except for that Social Security number, and they see the clerk type in that Social Security number and get it verified instantly, but the law requires that they have that Social Security card with them, and so 2139 removes that Social Security card requirement. This all comes largely as a result of 2008 Senate Bill 1080, which instituted after Governor Kulongoski's executive order for legal presence proof and tightening up identification requirements. What we have seen is folks, besides the Social Security card issue, folks who are perfectly legally in this country, and they are who they say they are, but the law requires very particular documentation to prove that. And when folks don't have all of those documents in their possession, it can take months to secure them. And so while the law currently allows a person to receive a 90-day temporary permit and a 60-day extension for a total of 150 days, to effectively obtain those documents, sometimes it simply isn't enough. Folks who have their birth certificate, for instance, in another state, just to get that birth certificate can take many months. Obtaining copies of documents showing their that they are a naturalized citizen, getting copies of those documents from the U.S. government can take upwards of a year. So this bill would allow DMV to continue granting extensions when folks demonstrate they're making efforts to obtain these documents so that they continue to drive. So it's all about.
How big of an issue has it been?
It has been an issue to the extent that I frequently get calls from legislators' offices with constituent issues on this very topic. The numbers are in 2010. We had about 936 people who needed more than that 150 days. So you're talking about 1,000 people. And frequently these are folks who are elderly. Perhaps they were born at home and don't even have a birth certificate, and folks who were adopted back in a time period when maybe that wasn't done in a legal sense but just done as a practical matter. And linking up documents going back in time can be very difficult. So this provides DMV the opportunity to let these people continue to try to obtain their documents and for us to assist them in doing that.
Senator Gerard?
Two questions. The first, if I read this right, I don't see why this has anything to do with the Social Security number. Let me just read. Okay, this is what we're changing it to. Provide the Social Security number assigned to the person by the United States Social Security Administration and proof of legal presence in the United States. That changes provide proof of both legal presence in the United States and a Social Security number. What's the difference?
Chair Byron, Senator Girard, that has been interpreted to mean proof of legal presence and proof of the Social Security number, meaning a Social Security card or other official document showing that Social Security number.
But if you say that you can type in the number and it proves itself that way, I don't see why you would have to have the card.
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, that's the way it's been interpreted. Part of that comes to us from the Federal Real ID Act, and so that's where that requirement has come from.
Okay, and the second question I have has to do with illegal aliens, and I mean, that was, to be honest, that's the reason that we passed most of this. So how much is this going to open the door by granting the temporary driver's licenses?
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, thank you very much for that question, Senator. It will not. The documentation still has to be shown to be able to get the permanent license. Folks need to certify while they're trying to get that temporary thing that they are legally present, and after the first extension have to show demonstrated proof that they're making real attempts at getting documents that truly exist. The vast, vast majority of folks who have gotten these extensions end up in the end getting that permanent license or permanent ID card showing all the documents that they need to have. It just has taken them more time because of these situations that exist in procuring documents.
I'm not sure I buy that, but let some other people ask some more questions.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amy, the proof of the Social Security number is considered to be the Social Security card, correct?
Chair Beyer and Senator Edwards, a Social Security card or other document such as a tax form, correct?
Okay. So the follow-up. So has there been developed in, you know, the last decade or more recent years anything special about that card that makes it particularly secure and unforgeable or counterfeitable, if that's a word, in the first place? Because I know I miraculously still have mine that I chicken scratched my name on when I was probably 9 years old. Doesn't look anything like my signature now, and there's nothing about the card that looks like it could have been run off at a Kinko's. You know, so
Chair Beyer,
it's not exactly a secure looking
document. There's a market for those.
There probably is, but not a market for that.
No doubt. Chair Beyer and Senator Edwards, there's, to my knowledge, there's nothing about the Social Security card. It's still that sort of cardstock document,
okay.
And that's it.
Amy, isn't the check, though, that when it's not the card, it's the number, and while they're there, they run it in the computer and match it to the federal, and if the name comes up differently?
Chair Beyer, that's exactly right. Correct. Literally, the clerk at the DMV counter types it in, and it pops up, yes, this, you know, number belongs to so-and-so, and with matching up the identification documents and that number, as well as birth certificate and all these other things, it's a highly secure process without the card.
Are you done?
I am done. Yeah. You made my point.
Back to Senator Girard.
Actually, I got some clarifications a little bit by line 22 through 24. But it's all predicated on a rule defined by the department. So it seems to me like the department could just do this by rule and save us to having to do the bill if we didn't like the last part of the bill.
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, as you note on line 22, a line being deleted is, a person provides proof of a Social Security number by submitting valid documentation, and then as defined by rule. If what would be valid documentation if not something other than writing it out on a piece of paper? Otherwise, we are sending people away to get their Social Security card or their tax document or other thing other than writing it on a piece of paper.
I know, but you made the rule that you're trying to overturn by statute. That's what I'm saying.
Senator Beyer and Chair Girard, I would respectfully disagree that valid documentation has to be something. There has to be something there. And we literally turn people away from DMV because the only thing they don't have.
Senator, I suspect they wouldn't be here if their DOJ attorney didn't tell them they had.
But this is valid documentation as defined by the department by rule.
Yeah. Apparently the AG doesn't agree with your interpretation. Senator Edwards?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, checking them in the system doesn't constitute valid documentation. I mean, if they're in the system and that number matches with who they say they are, that does not constitute documentation. And the only thing that does constitute documentation, you're saying, thus far, is this flimsy little cardstock card that could probably be done, you know, on a Mac and run off at a Kinko's.
Chair Byer, Senator Edwards, correct, or a tax document, which
tax
could, in theory, just probably at least as easily be generated by someone.
Sure.
But the law, the statute currently requires a document.
Providing a tax document doesn't mean it was ever sent in.
Absolutely accurate, Chair.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Amy. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2139? Okay. Well, we're going to close the public hearing and open work session on House Bill 2139.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starrs, move the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
The fact that he made the motion means he wants to carry it.
Okay. Is there opposition to the bill? Senator Drudge opposed? Anybody else? House Bill 2139 is moved to the House to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Girard is opposed. We'll close on that. And Senator Starr, would you like to carry?
Certainly, I'd be most happy to do that.
Senator Starr will carry. And let's see. Now we're down to we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3316. Richard.
House Bill 3316 adds photogrammetric mapping and transportation planning to the list of services subject to procedures for contracting with architects, engineers, and land surveyors. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact. We also have a -5 amendment that I have no revenue impact, but I have not yet received a fiscal impact statement on.
Okay, so these are proposed amendments?
Yep.
Okay. Ms. Roberts and Jitsu? Lasko? Okay. And it looks like there's a couple other. Whoever's all with you guys, come on up. I can't read them all. Koba and
Troy.
And, okay. Whoever wants to start. Mr. Goba.
That'll be me, sir.
Good afternoon, Chair Byer, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, here this afternoon representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon, ACEC Oregon, in strong support of House Bill 3316. We are a professional organization representing more than 110 firms, 3,500 employees across the state of Oregon, and our members range from small, locally owned firms to major companies providing design services to public and private clients across the globe and across Oregon. Our members are in strong support of expanding the requirements for qualification-based selection to more projects in Oregon to ensure the best and wisest use of our limited and valuable public funds. Simply put, qualification-based selection is a process for procuring design professionals used by state and local governments. In the Public Contracting Code, ORS 279C1110 is the procurement process for engineers, architects, land surveyors, and this bill adds photogrammetry. QBS is the procurement methodology supported by designers and, more importantly, supported by public works professionals across the country. Since the scope of the project is often not fully understood by the owner, the state or local government, and the design team, the QBS process allows a qualified group of professionals to team up and produce the best quality project for the available funds. The importance of quality design will resonate through the construction phase and for the years through the life cycle of any project. As we begin the hearing, a brief overview, and then I'll turn it over to Sue Laszlo and Troy Byer, letters of support in our packet as well. ACEC and other design associations have worked on this issue for a number of years, and it's important to understand that what this bill will do, 3316, will simply expand the requirements to use QBS to more projects in Oregon. Current law requires that all federal and state projects in Oregon use QBS to procure designers. In addition, local governments, projects that meet a threshold, a minimum project cost of $900,000 that contain at least 10% of state funds, so there's a match from the state government, must use this procurement methodology. We expand the requirement in House Bill 3316 to use QBS to procure design professionals to those projects that fall outside of the thresholds of a $900,000 and the 10% state match. While ensuring the best use of limited funds, the bill will also bring consistency to the design procurement process and consistency from jurisdiction to jurisdiction across the state. This will be a significant and valuable improvement to public procurement law in Oregon. Your packet that I gave you contains letters from a wide variety of interests on the issue. The information that I gave you behind the brown sheet has some strong letters, one from the American Public Works Association, which is the main professional organization of public works professionals in America. They put out annually, and it's in your silver packet there, the Red Book. Red Book is updated about every 5 years or so. That is something American Public Works has a strong commitment. If you read the letter, it doesn't necessarily support the bill. It supports the concept of qualification-based selection. Another letter from the West Lynn Wilsonville School District, very supportive of QBS. Also, we have a letter, strong letter from the Special Districts Association of Oregon and their 900 members in support of the bill. And also, we have a letter from Associated General Contractors who are very supportive of this bill as well. So the Dash 5 amendments, which were referenced, were drafted at our request after conversations with stakeholders, including ODOT and Department of Justice. And they do five main things that I could get into, but are written there. But with that, let me turn it over to Sue Laszlo or to Troy Bauer, president of our association. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present these comments in support of House Bill 3316-A. I'm Troy Bauer, Senior Vice President with Murray Smith & Associates. MSA was founded in Portland in 1980. We specialize in public works projects for public clients. We employ 75 people. I've personally been delivering public projects since 1990 in the state, and as Marshall said, I'm the president of ACEC Oregon. QBS is preferred by professional organizations, as Marshall mentioned, ACEC, AIA, APWA, contractors, and others. It is strongly supported by public agency facility managers, as demonstrated in the letters in the packet. QBS provides the best long-term value by selecting designers based upon their knowledge, capability, and ability to dedicate resources. You get the best ideas and approaches, which result in quality projects that stand the test of time. In today's economy and budget-constrained circumstances, QBS ensures each dollar spent delivers the best value. Changes to the laws proposed expands QBS to more public entities accountable to long-term return on investment by focusing on the entire life of a project. While we believe in QBS in its purest and simplest form, we have reached out to stakeholders and have incorporated amendments to accommodate their feedback. The QBS process, what makes it better? State or local government requests and reviews statements of qualifications and or proposals which consider experience of similar work, availability of qualified staff, suggested approach, and references. The firm determined to be the best fit by the agency collaborates with that owner to develop a detailed approach and scope of work which fits the project's unique needs and owner's expectations. Based on that collaborated scope of work, a draft level of effort and fee is developed, negotiated, and finalized, and a contract is executed. If unable to agree, the owner negotiates with the second-ranked proposer. Additional selection criteria can include locality, past history, and small business preference allowances. It doesn't take longer. Even when asking for price, there is the need to review the scope for what is included and excluded, and adjustments are made to the level of effort and fee. Price without defined scope, why is it bad? What are you buying? Too often, the owners do not include enough level of detail in the requested scope to be able to price fairly at the time of proposing. As such, not all the firms include everything required to get the job completed properly. The pricing is usually not on an apples-to-apples comparison basis. Price is a criteria. Why is that bad? Price can cloud the judgment of decision-makers who are less familiar with the details needed to achieve project success, and often lead to less qualified designers being selected. This results in project delays and higher costs via design and construction change orders. In my 20 years, I have seen price used anywhere from 5 to 50% of selection criteria. Regardless of its percentage, it undermines the value-laden selection criteria of experience, ability to meet project timelines, reputation via references, and ability to work collaboratively with the owner's team. The most qualified firms will often not propose on price-driven selection because there are other firms who don't understand the project complexities and then underestimate the effort needed to properly execute a project. QBS will provide for much better projects and consistency in design procurements and contracting. We are committed to conducting further QBS education statewide once the legislation is enacted, and I urge your support for House Bill 3316A. Thank you for this opportunity to comment.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Sue Laszlo, and I'm the chair of the ACEC Legislative Committee. I'm a registered professional engineer and vice president of HDR Engineering Incorporated, which also does public agency work. I'm past president and now emeritus member of the Oregon State Board of Engineering Examiners and Land Survey, and continue to be active in my profession and community. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3316. As Troy mentioned, it expands the qualifications-based selection law to include all local governments. I bring a unique perspective to the topic of QBS, as I've worked both in the public and private sector in roles that involve procurement of professional services. One of the things that I think you might hear from the public agencies that they are concerned is, one, that a consultant will game their price once they've been selected, and secondly, how the agency will know that they've got a reasonable and responsible price. Well, in answer to the first question, price is still a factor. It just appears later in the process. Once the agency has picked a consultant, they begin to negotiate fee. If the agency feels they cannot come to an agreement, discussions begin with the next highest-ranking firm. Based on my experience, the selected consultant is motivated to negotiate a fair scope and fair price. With respect to the second question, typically an agency solicits proposals based on an anticipated budget. If they haven't predetermined an expected fee, there are many ways an agency can determine what to expect for a design fee. All public work done by professionals for professional agencies is public information. I know, for example, ODOT keeps a database of rate schedules from consultants who are on their on-call rosters. In addition, there are general rules of thumb to help predict what the design fee should be based on a percentage of estimated construction costs. The benefits of QBS are significant and do lead to cost savings. Using QBS allows the agency and design professional to collaborate on the scope to allow for a solid return on investment by considering all aspects of the project needs. For a point of reference, design professional fees typically amount to around 1% of the total life cycle cost of the project. QBS creates a relationship that allows the agency and the consultant firm to work together to minimize long-term costs and unanticipated costs. This relationship ensures cost-effectiveness, and based on study findings, QBS-based projects demonstrate better results than the national average in terms of lower construction costs and lower schedule growth. In summary, there are positive outcomes resulting in expanding QBS as described in House Bill 3316. This is an economy that needs decisions based on solid return on investment, and I believe QBS helps us get there. Thank you for your consideration.
Good questions or this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the American Institute of Architects. We are here today in support of House Bill 3316. I think this has become a little bit more confusing than it should be, and I want to tell you clearly that House Bill 3316 is about quality, consistency, and competition. And I'll tell you briefly why those three things are important. Quality, consistency, and competition are what 3316 is about. We believe it lends to quality projects. Surveys have shown, studies have shown, and frankly, the longevity of projects have shown that quality projects result from qualification-based selection. Materials and labor can be bid. Ideas and collaboration cannot. We can estimate that the cost is about 10% of a project for design fees, but beyond that, we shouldn't be restricting folks and the quality construction that they can put together by using QBS. High-performance buildings, fewer cost changes and delays, better technology and sustainability are all results of using QBS over low bid choices. Procurement process is more consistent under QBS, and HB 3316 makes sure that that happens everywhere. The state uses it, the federal government uses it, the local governments use it sometimes. I have a long list of RFPs that have gone out where I have been contacted by both architects and engineers and asked for clarification as to why QBS was not used. That will no longer happen. Local governments will know when they need to use QBS, and architects, engineers, and other design professionals will know the process that they're entering into. However, while the process becomes more consistent with QBS, it does not become the same. The content is all locally controlled with QBS. What each public contracting agency wants to find and its design professional is something they get to choose. So the details of the RFP are all locally controlled. It's just the process of doing qualifications first and then price. That's the only uniformity that QBS requires and that HB 3316 now extends on. My third point was competition. HB 3316, we believe, the architects believe, architects who have 40% unemployment in this state, believes will help us become more competitive because it gives small and emerging and minority-owned businesses more of a chance to bid on public contracts. By raising the size of the project and broadening the different agencies that are involved in the exemption, because right now it's just the cities, we're raising it to $100,000, which is a $1 million project, at the first level, and then all the way up to $2.5 million project for a list level. So we're raising the exemptions for QBS, which allows some of my smaller firms to come in and start competing on public contracts, start building their portfolios, so that in years to come, they can come in and compete on qualification-based selection projects that are larger. So quality, consistency, competition, that's what you're getting from HB 3316. You are not getting a huge policy change. You already made that policy change in 2001. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions, and Cindy? Thank you very much.
Nobody asked questions.
Thank you. No questions. Tom Lauer, Scott Winkles, and David Barenberg.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Lauer from the Department of Transportation, specifically the Major Projects Manager. I'm here today to request that you consider the A5 amendments to this bill, which make several technical corrections to the bill to allow it to continue to function in harmony with the existing procurement bill. In particular, we would like, and we have been advised by our counsel, that this amendment would go a long way in resolving some challenges that are put forth by the bill and make it quite functional for us. Specifically, the first area is to allow us to amends the bill so that it allows us to adopt screening and selection procedures much as we do today by rule. As the bill was initially written, that would be limited in build in projects over $250,000, and that would allow us to be subject to protest because we have a lack of inability to set rules that set those procurement procedures. Additionally, the modifications by the A5 amendment would allow the state and local contracting boards to designate QBS contracts as personal service contracts, and again, putting it back into harmony as we currently have with the existing procurement rules. The third area is it allows us to have direct appointment in emergency contracts that exceed $100,000. And that we find to be very necessary when we're faced with a natural disaster and have to procure A&E services in a very limited time frame. And the fourth area is to restore the designation of the personal service contract for related services, again, putting it back into harmony with our current our existing procurement processes. With that, I'm open to any of your questions.
Questions?
Question.
Start.
Thank you. As I look at the amendment and look at the bill, the on line 12 of the amendment, do you have the amendment in front of you?
That's of the amendment or the bill?
Line 12 of the amendment says on page 4, line 5, delete and insert a period. If I look at the bill, line 5 of the bill, you delete and insert a period. Does the rest of that sentence remain? So we need
correct.
To capitalize that and move forward?
That's correct.
Okay, so it just separates that particular sentence into two sentences.
Right. Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Any other questions, Tom? Thank you, Tom. Scott?
Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in opposition to House Bill 3316. Going back a little bit, in the 03 and the 05 sessions, the legislature undertook a massive rewrite of the public contracting code. That was a process that involved all stakeholders at the table, involved the public contracting coalition, numerous conversations, and two legislative sessions to get it right. The result of that project is the contracting code as it stands today. There have been some minor tweaks here and there, but by and large, that's what we're operating under today. The experience of the League of Oregon City members is that that process worked, that the least cost principle worked well for Oregon cities, and it worked well to ensure the responsible use of public dollars. We're not sure what problem we are actually fixing with this legislation when it comes to local government construction. Additionally, I would remind the committee that this committee passed out Senate Bill 722 earlier in the session. That was a bill that dealt with a permissible allowable departure from the least cost principle dealing with the alternative means of contracting. The testimony from the committee, as I recollect, was based on there was some contractors who felt that there were favoritism was shown. It wasn't a fair process. I would juxtapose House Bill 3316 with the position the committee took in 722, where in 722 it was concerned about that departure from the allowable permissive departure from the least cost principle, and now we are looking at a mandated departure from the least cost principle. I don't believe it is illogical to assume that the same issues that brought forward 722 would not arise should this body pass House Bill 3316. Additionally, in local government contracting, a lot of the buildings that local cities build are designs pulled off of a shelf. You know, a fire station is not a complicated design. We build these regularly. There's a general blueprint. Sure, we want a licensed professional to look at that project and ensure that and make whatever adjustments based on topography or local circumstances, but it doesn't require the same level of detail. However, this bill would require us to go through the QBS system. And in closing, I would simply say that if this legislature has looked at numerous public contracting bills that have sought to direct cities on what materials to use in construction, who to hire to design, who to hire to build, where to buy the products from. If there is an appetite for a significant rewrite of the public contracting code, let's go back to the system that we know worked, where we did it holistically with everybody at the table, identifying problems and coming up with solutions. And with that, I'm eager for your questions.
David? Thank you, Chair Byer and members of the committee. I'm David Barenberg, representing the City of Portland.
we're unclear on what the problem is that we're trying to solve here. We build many things in the city. We use qualifications in our selection. We also look at price. We build, as Scott said, a number of things that are relatively standard in terms of fire stations, other structures. We have a large wealth of experience in adopting the or putting forward the specifications of buildings and other structures that we would like to see constructed. We think that price is an important tool, that there may be firms that are close in rank and offer similar skills and talents, but may differ in the amount that they charge in substantial ways. And we do not see why this legislation is extended to preempt city's authority to have a process that has worked so far for us. We haven't seen problems that have been pointed out in our procurement method. We just see a mechanism that is being preferred by those in the profession that are putting forward a mechanism that they think works better. We think that the system that we have has worked for our city, and with that, we'd urge you not to advance the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Questions? Senator Gerard?
Did you oppose this in the House?
Yes, Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, yes, I testified in opposition to the House.
Floor, Senator Starr.
Thank you. Either one of the local government folks, do either local governments use this method today in contracting? Don't they use this method today?
Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, in some cases they do if they're you meet the current threshold where there's the state significant state involvement in the project.
Senator Burdick?
Do you have any idea on how this would increase costs on projects like routine projects, you know, out of the box, projects that you really don't feel like you need quality based bidding?
Chair Beyer, Senator Burdick, first thing is, in terms of buildings, we think we still build quality buildings and use quality as a, you know, major selection criteria in what it is that we do. We also do, you know, use price. I don't have a quantified difference that we can show. I just know that our contracting professionals think that it is significant. They also think that the process where you go to one, and if you don't think that the top-rated consulting firm, and you haven't aren't able to agree on price, that you then begin negotiations anew with the second and possibly with the third, that takes up time and can slow down advancing, you know, a project was another concern.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Thank you very much, gentlemen. That is everyone I had signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 3316. That's the pleasure of the committee. Well, we've got an amendment sitting out there, and we have the bill.
Chair, could we have another explanation of the amendment?
Okay. Tom, could you, do you have specific questions, or do you just want to...
No, I just missed it.
Could you do it once over quickly again on why the amendment, what it does? Probably more general.
More general. The bill goes through and amends the procurement code, and in doing so, several references were either modified or changed or dropped as the bill goes through and references it. What we're attempting to do is affect all the outcomes that were put forward in the bill, and the agency is neutral on this bill. However, we wanted to affect all the outcomes of it, but maintain the normal way we go about doing business, i.e., the ability to set procurement standards or a selection process and have it set out in the rules that the agency will adopt wrapped around these bills, so that when we go through a procurement, a non-winning firm couldn't protest this because we selected a criteria that wasn't based in rules and therefore could be thought of as arbitrary. So we want the procurement process to move in a smooth and effective process. Additionally, typically, professional services and related services that are called for in this contract are generally deemed within the procurement code as personal services, in contrast to good and trades or construction. Mm-hmm. So keeping that reference specifically in there to personal services allows us to use a part of the existing procurement code and all the elements and all the parts of our rules that make it effective. Thirdly, we have a problem of dealing with emergency contracts. When we're in an emergency situation, we need to bring in firms quickly and promptly so that we can restore a road to community service. The way this bill would read without the amendment, it would limit us at direct appointments at $100,000. In large emergencies such as in the 96 event, we needed services greater than that to quickly put roads back in place. This amendment would restore that authority that we currently have today.
Okay, thank you for humoring me. So this is
Mr. Kobler, I should ask you, is the bill sponsors, are they supportive of the A5s?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Marshall Kobler with the American Council of Engineering Companies. Yes, we are. We work closely with Mr. Lauer and also with one of Oregon's leading experts, Blake Underwood, with the Department of Justice, on these amendments and have worked closely with them throughout this process.
Okay, and I see Ms. Roberts shaking her head positively as well. Okay, other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I move the -A5 amendments to the bill.
Senator Starr has moved the -5 amendments to House Bill 3316. Is there a discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, the -5 amendments to House Bill 3516 have been adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would move the bill.
We don't have a fiscal on the amendments.
Oh, we don't have a fiscal? Oh, that one slipped through.
No
fiscal, huh?
No.
All right.
No, on the amendments. It's fine.
We'll have to wait, gentlemen, ladies. Apparently, we have to wait for fiscal, so that's all we can do today. We're in the work session on House Bill 3316. That takes us to the end of the agenda for today. Is there anything else to come before the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I just want to make a statement about the landscape contractors.
Yes.
I opposed those bills today, and, you know, my frustration is how those bills, those laws regulating landscape contractors have evolved over the years. I would hope perhaps, I don't know, maybe it makes sense to have a group look at that set of statutes in the interim and see, is this the best way as a state for us to regulate this particular industry? They've evolved over time. I think they're convoluted and not very clear, and we keep adding to it piecemeal every session, and I'm not convinced that the current statutory scheme is the most appropriate one, and might be something that is worth taking a look at some point in time.
I'm thinking that might be something we want to do in the interim. Okay. Any other comments? Seeing none, we adjourn.